this country's not going to be saved from the top, because that's where all the rot is. It's too deep. It's going to be saved from the grassroots.
Good morning and welcome to The Crossroads for another day. It's January the 21st in Australia and quite a pleasant day. I have with me today from Canada, Mr. Robert Klink. How are you, Robert?
I'm fine, Neville, and good to be with you again. I always look forward to these sessions. I was all away for a while, but I'm glad to be back.
Very good. Very good. We've had some interesting things happening here. You're aware of what happened at Bondi, of course. We had a...
Read about it. I don't know exactly what happened. All these events have difficult aspects that are hard to understand. And when the government immediately jumps on these as opportunities to bring in more stringent gun controls, you know, it's I don't know.
Yeah. What do you think? We're facing legislation, of course, because of it. It was a horrific attack. 15 people, I believe, were killed, and many others wounded by two Islamic extremists shooting into a crowd at Bondi Beach, which happened to be a Jewish celebration of Hanukkah. And yes, a terribly tragic event. But we also know that Israel and the Islamists have been fighting for many years. So whilst something that's never happened in Australia before, it certainly happens in other places around the world. And it is a very sad thing when two cultures can't get along like that. But, you know, the...
What happened to the shooters? One was captured.
One was killed. And one was captured. We don't know. I don't know what's happened to him since. We had gun laws and everything in place, whereas these people shouldn't have had what they had. The son was known to ASIO. It's a father and son duo. And he'd been targeted and looked at. In effect, as far as I can tell, we had all the laws there to prevent this sort of thing from happening because they were both people of significance. And yet it still happened. So something fell down somewhere along the way. They've promised some sort of a royal commission, but whether it's a royal commission into what they believe are hate crimes or free speech, or which is what they're pushing, I don't know how much will go in to say who didn't do their job. You know, why did it fail? The laws are there specifically now. We've seen a lot of rubbish come out of it too. Have you ever heard of a belt-fed ammunition magazine?
I don't think so, but I've heard of some strange things lately. I don't pay too much attention to gun matters. I've never been a big fan of that, but I don't object to people having private ownership of firearms. If everybody on my street had a firearm, I wouldn't be uncomfortable, you know. But
as an instance of how the legislation was drafted fairly quickly, a lot of the stuff was drafted fairly quickly. A magazine is a magazine. It contains bullets. If it's belt-fed, it's on a belt and it feeds into the gun. So you can't have... The two are mutually exclusive. You either have a magazine, which is full of bullets, or you have a belt-fed mechanism.
But with a belt, you can have more bullets, I guess, probably.
Well, it's limited to the length of the belt, I guess. They're generally unwieldy and they generally cause all sorts of problems. You would have seen them, you know, World War II, Vietnam sort of thing. But, yeah, they don't exist in... current life or in Australia, basically, but as a belt-fed ammunition magazine, that the terminology is totally wrong. That's not the only terminology that was wrong in the quickly prepared or quickly brought out of hiding legislation that was brought forward. And most of that came about because we're using straight pull shotguns and pulling their reloads out of the belt on the hip. You know, when you go shooting, if you go duck shooting, you have an ammunition belt around your waist so that you've got access to your shells. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you shoot, you can then pull a few out of the belt, which you've already got ready, and pop them in. Well, that's what he was doing. And, of course, the media immediately turned that into a belt-fed, you know, shotgun, which totally denies the reality of what happened. And you know, then, of course, they're talking about, you know, straight pulls and all sorts of things. And I don't think any of them really know what they're talking about when they start discussing those sorts of things. But that's all aside. I just sort of mentioned that because you know, when people wish to introduce legislation straight on top of such a happening, such as they did in at Port Arthur here when we had 35 people killed, and 9/11 when the attacks happened, you know, there's so much stuff that happened straight afterwards in America that and Australia, you know, our people cracked down. You know, you couldn't carry a certain amount of hand wash in your luggage, you couldn't have, you know, deodorant cans, all sorts of things when you hopped on a plane, you know. They really went crazy over it without too much thought, I think. And in this case, they've done the same thing. They've introduced what was going to be a combination bill, hate crimes legislation, and gun buyback, etc. And there was some hue and cry about how much was included in it. There's a lot of people speaking out against it, but not necessarily within this political sphere. They were all pushing for it, and the media were pushing for it as well. So it was mostly social media that was kicking up, and you know, private individuals. A few senators warned us. A few of our members were not happy, usually the alternative members. But both parties, except for the Liberal Party, who sort of said, oh, well, you know, we haven't had a say. We think we should resist it. And fortunately for them, or fortunately for them, I don't know which you want to call it, our Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, then said, threw it back onto the Liberals and said, well, you know, what would you have? So they've gone through, and it's only taken them a matter of days, and suddenly they've produced this miraculous new draft now that they've all voted on. So the Libs have done a complete turnabout now that they've got their name on the list of having, oh, we've looked at it, we reckon it's all right. They seem to think they're the saviours. But of course, when you go through the legislation, which is over 500 pages, I believe, I have a list of it here, which says 144. But Senator Ralph Babette was on this morning saying that he only had, you know, like 14 hours to look at the whole 500 pages that he was presented with. And then we're supposed to make a decision on, and they effectively gagged any debate in Parliament too. They had a couple, and then they had a couple of discussions over it, and then they just gagged it and put it to a vote, which the result was an overwhelming, they've accepted it basically.
So it never went through the committee process? Was it studied by committee?
If it was, it was a very short, I don't think it was studied by any committee. They sort of poo-pooed that. The only committee you get these days in Parliament seems to be, you know, well, we'll scratch your back and you'll scratch mine and we'll pretend we've looked at it. That's what I see it as, you know, and I have, until I see something different, that's, you know, I'm cynical enough to believe that that's the way it works. But, so the in the link in the side there, if you're interested, the first link there is for the 13th of January version of the bill. That's the latest one I could find on the web this morning. Arnie's popped up another one there with the fact sheet for combating anti-Semitism, hate and extremism bill. And basically, in the initial stages, all the talk was around making certain groups prohibited. And part of that was political opinion. So on the basis of political opinion, that's written in there as well. So we've seen this happen in history, where they introduce prohibited groups on the basis of some form of happening, on the basis of some form of, well, you know, we think they're extremists, or they don't fit our concept of what is correct, politically correct, so we're going to call them a prohibited group and create them as an outlier then, and we can prosecute them as at our desire. Hitler got rid of the communists that way, put them in jail. You know, over the years, all dictators tend to put their opposition in jail, and that's sort of, I think that's personally, that's what we're sort of starting to see here. Anyone who doesn't agree with the current political woke opinion that's been pushed will be targeted. And that was the issue that everyone came up with. in the initial stages, and now they've said, oh no, it's not in that section now anymore. And again this morning, someone else who's done a bit more research than me was talking about it and said, well, no, it's not in that section anymore. They've transferred it to section such and such. So the bill being broken up into several sections and being a huge number of pages long and written in the usual legal doublespeak, you go through and you find that, yes, okay, it strengthens sections, offences in 80.2A and 80.2B in the criminal code, et cetera, et cetera. And then, of course, it mentions at the end of that, or political opinion. So you can be liable for hate speech for a political opinion. That's how it reads to me. But again, I'm no, you know, I'm no international lawyer. So all I know is that there's a lot of Orwellian doublespeak in it. And, you know, the fact that they weren't allowed to debate it effectively in Parliament was pushed through is scary. I believe you've got something similar. You've had something similar brought in Canada some time ago. Or
just as COVID was beginning in 2020, that was in February, I think, here. And in April, there was a shooting in Nova Scotia in which 23 people were killed. Now, some people say 22 because one of the persons killed was a pregnant woman, and of course, the baby was killed too. And it was very strange, and all the media said it was 22 people. But as far as I know, if you kill a pregnant woman and the baby dies, normally you can be prosecuted for two murders. I think that's the law. So, you know, there's always diminishing the significance of unborn children's lives, I guess. But anyway, we had 23 people killed over a period, I think they said, of 13 hours. And this guy, who had been driving through town in an RCMP car with all the decals of the RCMP, you couldn't have told it from a regular RCMP cruiser. He was dressed.
That's your Royal Canadian Mounted Police, too, just for those who may not be aware of that. Yeah.
The Federal Police Force. And he was dressed in authentic RCMP clothing because, I don't know, he had an uncle or something, a couple of people in his family who were RCMP, and he collected this stuff, kind of memorabilia. But he was driving through town, and the police knew about this. How he couldn't have been arrested for impersonating an officer, I don't know. But he got away with this, and then I don't know what, if he went berserk, I don't know what that was all about, but he started to shoot people, not only shoot them, burn down their homes. I think he burned down about four homes. He rampaged all over the place. And then the police were looking for him, but they said, well, we assume that he has committed suicide. He was sleeping in the back of a building somewhere, and the next morning he resumed his killing. And he, I don't know, he in total he killed 23 people over a 13-hour period, and the police actually abandoned their search for him in that process. It was unbelievable, really, but what really you can't understand is how somebody can go around impersonating an officer, a police officer, without, when the police know that he's doing that, and he doesn't get stopped. It's, and this guy was a smuggler. He was smuggling guns and drugs and even hand grenades in from the United States. I think he had connections to the Hells Angels and other Mike Bug gangs, you know, and just got away with it until he ended up killing all these people. And then they had a commission of inquiry, and it was really quite a joke, a laughable thing. And really, it was most disturbing. But as soon as the event occurred, Mr. Trudeau and his government jumped on it and said, we need to change our gun restriction laws. Well, all the guns this guy had were illegal. He didn't have to change the laws. He was violating the laws in every way. So all we had to do was apply the existing laws. Mm-hmm. So we had a very dramatic event similar to that Bondi Beach thing, although that was not prolonged the way this thing in Nova Scotia was, you know. 13 hours of killing and going around burning houses down. He stopped two women on the road because he was driving a police cruiser. So he puts his flashing lights on, the women stop, and he goes and shoots them in the head. And one of these poor women lay on the pavement of the highway for, I think, 8 hours before she actually died under the care of the RCMP. The RCMP showed up and they didn't remove her. They assumed she was dead because she'd been shot in the head, but she was wearing this Fitbit device that showed that her heart was still beating for that 8 hours. I mean, it just, so discouraging that there doesn't seem to be any professionalism left in these organizations. And I hope we'll see some professionalism now that the Federal Court of Appeal has said that the Trudeau government violated the Constitution and violated the Charter of Rights when they imposed the Emergencies Act during the trucker protest. This is a verdict that was rendered, and it has now been confirmed by the Court of Appeal. Well, what happens when the government is violating the Constitution? You know, it seems to me it's a serious matter, but you'd think the, you know, there'd be an investigation, that the opposition parties would be on top of it, but I'm sure nothing's going to happen. They can get away with anything with impunity, it seems. Really a sad state of affairs we have.
But on top of all that, they brought in more hate speech, or apart from gun control, did they limit your freedom of speech as well?
Well, they've been doing that lately. They had three pieces of legislation. I don't know if they're all about speech, but I haven't studied this as well as I would have if I'd known we were going to talk about this tonight. But one of them has raised a lot of resistance objections because they say it is a real infringement on freedom of speech. And this is, I think it, if it's not passed, it's in third reading in the House of Commons now. I think it goes from the House of Commons to the Senate, then back to the House of Commons, and it's signed by the Governor General to make it official law. But I don't think it's formally accepted yet, but it's, I don't see anything that's going to prevent it from being accepted, because the opposition party is impotent, and you know, they seem to be as intimidated as the government when it comes to taking a principled stand that defends the rights of the population. So, yeah, but the same thing's going on in the UK now. They've got that, what do they call that? Got a different sort of term for it than we're familiar with, but it's all about, oh, the harms bill, writing on the internet and that sort of thing. You know, it's an attack on freedom of speech, and it's all revolving around the protection of favored groups. Mm-hmm. Well, this is a complete departure from our whole concept of, you know, equality before the law and equal protection and that sort of thing. It's unfortunately, it's been undermined for a long time now, because the establishment of all these particularly protected groups who apparently are somehow superior to the rest of the population. But, you know, it's a progressive thing, and it's gone very far now, with quite a few groups being singled out for special protection. If you have proper laws, you don't have to single people out for special protection. The general law will protect them. And if it doesn't, it's not a well-conceived law, I would say.
Online harms bill. Okay, yes, it was the UK.
That's right, yeah.
Yep. I'm just interested. I mean, you know, as free speech is being limited across all of the Western nations, basically. Online is featured significantly because I guess it's the newest way of disseminating opinions or talking about things, engaging in robust discussion is what we would originally have called it, you know. And that's something that we need to do if we wish to keep our social character. We need to discuss the things that we're facing. We need to be unafraid to say what we feel. The only way you can have a proper, robust discussion is if you don't fear what you might say. If you have a foot in mouth moment, you say something nasty, you can always apologize. If you say something without thinking, that's just nature. It's just, that's just human beings. We had a political leader here in Victoria, a Liberal leader called Jeff Kennett, and he was often quoted by the media as having done a foot in mouth moment. He used to say things that, you know, quite often were, engage brain after you've said it sort of thing. Not that I'm disparaging of him. I don't have a lot of time for him, but, you know, everybody does it. And it, I think at one point it was acceptable. Okay, that's your fallible. You know, you've, everybody's fallible. You can, you know, say what you need to say, but if it's something that needs to be got out in the open, if we need to discuss it, then we shouldn't be afraid of being put in jail for trying to discuss it. And that's
what... Nobody has to believe what you say. They can use their judgment, you know. So they're assuming people are incapable of assessing the truthfulness of these statements. Although truth in Canada, truth has been ruled not to be a defense in the, what are these, it's a lower form of court, but because if you are hurting somebody's feelings, you're committing an illegal act, you know? Well, surely we want a more robust population than that. People who can resist hurtful words. But
I read something.
If it goes on to an emotional basis, it's chaos. Because somebody who says their feelings are hurt can lodge a complaint with the police and you can be arrested for it, you know? There are instances of this. It's not generalized yet, but
that's effectively
how the courts handle it, but it's...
That's effectively what's within some of our current laws that they're pushing through or that they have put through the lower house. There's also another part where it is that, where are we? They don't even have to prove that someone was offended by it, what you said, to make it a crime.
Somebody else can make that judgment for them, I suppose.
Yeah. Someone else can make that judgment, you know. And like you say, you know, truth is not a defense in some cases, because if someone feels as though they have been violated or have been offended, then whether it's true or not, it doesn't really come into it, because you've already committed the crime and you will be judged accordingly. So this is the problem. It's Orwellian, the Orwellian terms and the doublespeak that's been put in there. It's just, and you know, like you say, your opposition is very weak, and not doing much. Well, our opposition's much the same. They've basically betrayed the nation, and I can't see any change. I mean, I've seen them working together for so long, in everything they do, that, you know, one does it more slowly than the other, but they're all doing the same thing. They are two wings of the same bird. You can't really change that. The bill has only gone through the lower house here, so it still has to be presented to the Senate. Now, our Senate is different to yours. We're lucky. We still elect our senators. Now, in many cases, of course, if they belong to a political party, that nasty swear word, which I hate to use, they are selected before they're elected. So you get a choice of, you know, chocolate arsenic, strawberry arsenic, or vanilla arsenic, according to the political party. And you can elect, you know, well, they select one of those, and then you've got your choice. But we also elect many of our independents and many of our true free speech representatives within the Senate as senators, and the minor parties tend to get more of a go there. So we do have the ability to write to our senators and really, you know, hammer home how much we do not want this bill to pass through Senate, because if it gets rejected in Senate, it has to go back to our house. Not correct? It passed the Senate. Oh, okay. Sorry. Beg your pardon. It's passed the Senate. I did not realize that. I thought it had just gone in at the first. Okay, well, we don't have time to talk to our senators then, because it's not going to make any difference. It appears we've got to live with it. I do also note that it is retroactive, which means that if you say anything that's been said prior to its introduction is also available to be looked at. So that's always a good thing, isn't it?
Going back to the time when you were a child.
Probably, yeah, yeah. When really? The sticks and stones will break your bones was all, you know, all well and good, and you can say horrible things. But and you generally did at times. That's sort of part of growing up. But hopefully, yeah, by the time you've grown up, you're capable of thinking before you speak. But there will be times when we all don't. There will be times in the heat of the moment you'll say something. So what's it come to? Is that you know, we now have to be very careful. And if we're a targeted person, if we're a person of interest to the political establishment because we hold a different political opinion, they just hang around and wait until we actually say something, and then bang, we've got 5 or 10 years in jail.
That's right. And they make examples of a few people in order to induce self-censorship on the part of everybody, because people become afraid to speak their minds. And you know, that was a great virtue of our society, that people could say what they thought without fear of, unless it was a slander or a libel or something, without fear
of laws for.
But now you make somebody unhappy and you can go to jail. It's really unbelievable and very sad. It's a great deterioration in the health of the discourse in our society, I think.
You only have to go online and start looking at what's been happening in Starmer's UK, you know, where they've been putting people in jail for tweets.
Yes, and more and more.
And, you know, you think it can't happen here, and yet that's exactly what they're bringing in. This is exactly the sort of thing that, you know, we're going to look forward to.
Yeah.
There's exactly. All the riots and carry on that's going on over there, and that's we're going to have to get to that point. Is this what our government is forcing us to do? Because the reality is, if that's what's happened over there, because people are being, you know, put into jail for comments they've made, it doesn't mean they're forcing us into the same situation as the UK, where we're going to have to, you know, get more aggressive. I don't like the idea of that, and I certainly would not be condoning, you know, violence. But what other out have you got? Other countries are showing that this is what tends to happen. You know, is that what they're after? Do they want to bring in martial law?
If need be, I'm sure that they wouldn't mind that. So they want maybe to provoke people to the point where they react in some violent way, you know, they're so frustrated, and then they can invoke martial law, and then they clamp down. But I don't know.
You have anything else on the horizon that's happening in Canada at the moment that you'd like to speak about?
Well, I did mention this Court of Appeal judgment, which I think should lead to some sort of action on the part of a component of the population anyway. There should be an insistence that the people who were responsible for seizing people's bank accounts, I think they seized about 250 people's bank accounts and during the trucker convoy, you know. And I think even that some of those people committed suicide. And yet the government is not going to be held accountable for imposing a non-constitutional regime on the population and driving so many people to despair. It's almost inconceivable that they could get away with that, but they always seem to. So one hopes that there will be some sort of further investigation. I doubt it, because every time they investigate it looked worse for the perpetrators. But I wonder how comfortable Mr. Trudeau's life is going to be in Canada in future, because he's going to have a lot of people who wouldn't want to see him on the street. But look at Tony Blair, who got the UK involved in that Iraq war travesty. And now what, he's getting new appointments all the time. He's on the Trump, I forget what it is, some kind of peace resolution for the war in Ukraine, I think. I think it's in Ukraine, not in Palestine. But, you know, he goes from wonderful position to wonderful position, and he's some sort of international glamorous star, but he's a war criminal. That's what he is. He lied to get his country into a war, which is, I mean, there are a lot of people in Britain who don't like him either. And some at least have tried to do a citizen's arrest of him, but you're not going to get any support from the, you know, police or judicial authorities if you try something like that, no matter how justified it might be.
Yep. Yeah, we've seen the same thing here with Daniel Andrews in Victoria. He was our premier for quite a time over COVID, introduced the most extreme lockdowns and everything else.
Yeah.
You know, they've been pushing to try and get some sort of accountability there too, but each time the courts are either refusing to hear it or throwing it out for some reason or another. Yeah, it's an ongoing thing. I don't know how you really deal with that sort of thing. When a government goes against the Constitution and does something illegal, one would assume that the Attorney General, who is supposed to be in control of the legal side of things, should be morally obligated to look into it and see who caused it and, you know, the reasons behind it. And if anyone is guilty or not, but the Attorney Generals, of course, are part of the political machine, so they weren't investigating themselves.
In Canada, early in the Trudeau government, there was a woman from BC. She was actually a native woman, and she was the Attorney General of Canada. Of course, this was a wonderful appointment, not only Indigenous, but a woman, so, you know. But when the... a corporation that the Trudeau family is quite closely related to was accused of some kind of illegality, I think in finances or something like that. She insisted on prosecution. So they fired her. That was how the Trudeau government dealt with somebody trying to do their job properly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but at least she was there, and you know, it is reassuring that once in a while there's a person who takes their formal responsibilities seriously and tries to do a proper job. But it's very hard to do in a corrupt environment, and that seems to be the kind of politics we have now.
Yeah. So you wonder how we're supposed to correct these problems. I guess I was going to make a comment about the Senate before when we were talking earlier. I said that, you know, we at least elect our Senate. Yours is appointed by the government. I guess that if it gets to the point in this country where the Senate starts being the problem, there's always a possibility that, you know, they'll work out some way of dealing with the Senate. But at the moment, it's written in our constitution, and there has to be a referendum of all the states and a majority in all the states to change anything like that. I guess we're lucky we don't have your system where the government appoints the Senate for life.
It's funny how it works, because when there's Liberal government, all the senators appointed are Liberal hacks. And when it's a Conservative government, which isn't very often, you know, they alternate a little bit, but generally the Liberals are the party in power in Canada. Then when the Conservatives are in power, it's all Conservative appointments. But it makes it a little bit farcical. A strange thing that happened was when early in Trudeau's tenure, he actually said that he was making the Liberal senators independent of the Liberal Party policy. And that was a very strange thing for him to be doing, but it didn't last long, and now they're all back in the fold. So I don't know where he got that idea. Maybe it was just a PR exercise, I'm not sure. But
political expediency.
It's uncharacteristic, yeah. And I certainly don't trust, I never trusted him to be doing anything proper. He was a blight on the political scene, I'm afraid.
And other things that have been happening over here, of course, we've had quite a few wildfires. Well, not wildfires, bushfires, we call them here. Our large tracts of land have been going up. Our state in Victoria, because that's the one I know about, has had quite a huge amount of fire. The current politicians in charge of delivering funding have just cut our CFA, our Country Fire Authority budget, by $55.5 million at a time when they should really be investing heaps in it, and also at a time when they've increased the taxes on the fire levy by a huge amount. So they're not even giving back what they've increased in taxes to try and upgrade the old tankers and the volunteers, to help the volunteers who go out and put themselves in front of all this. And they've already got, you know, the monetary equivalent of millions of dollars by the volunteers putting their life and time on the line, which they don't have to pay for, and they can't be bothered to fund them properly. And that's what it comes down to. But again, you know, we're seeing a government that is broke and doesn't have any idea of how to deal with it, raising taxes, increasing levies, and basically cutting back on the ability to firefight. But it doesn't stop there either, because I don't know whether it's the same. You have wildfires and that as well. But mm-hmm. we used to do quite a lot of proactive, like early, the roadsides would be slashed and kept clear. We used to have grazing in the high country to keep the grass down so that we didn't have a huge amount of undergrowth. All these things are slowly being removed. And a lot of it's due to monetary restrictions. The shires can no longer, you know, slash the roadsides as much as they should. But then there's the dispute, of course, between national roads and state roads and local roads and whose jurisdiction it falls under to clear the rubbish. And we also are no longer allowed to gather the fallen timber or wood, etc., that comes off the side of the road, so you can be prosecuted for that, so less people do that. We've still got in our area, you know, after a storm everybody goes out and basically cleans up, so the farmers with their tractors and the local blokes with their utes will go out and they'll get rid of the stuff off the side of the road. But more and more we're seeing that when it comes to the fire season, we're unprepared. And yet we know it comes every year. And I'd almost go so far as to say some of it is willful. They want to see fires because they want to push the climate narrative.
Yes.
Again, you know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that putting a firebreak around a property is the way you help to reduce the risk and gives you an area where you can work from. But if you go out in the bush, the roads are so bad, there's no real firebreaks prepared, and access becomes a point of, you know, someone's going to get trapped there eventually. I've seen a number of YouTubers and four-wheel drivers in Australia putting up video footage of where they've gone onto this fire track, which is supposed to be a fire track, and they're having trouble getting through because of the overgrowth. And the undergrowth, like, it's just, there's no longer a clear path for a fire truck. They're struggling to get a little four-wheel drive through. So is it willful neglect? You know, is that what they want? Again, knowing what they want with free speech, it I don't know, I guess I'm cynical. But I know that's what we're seeing here, and we're seeing it more and more. Both my wife and my son are active in the CFA, and they go out regularly. But, you know, I don't know, just the observations that I would make compared to in the 70s or 80s when we had a fairly large block of land over in Burma, you know, we would regularly make sure that the fence lines had a fire break on each side of them. Each neighbouring farmer would plough up, you know, four or five widths of their fence line to ensure that if there was a problem, they could at least travel the fence lines and help to put the fire out and that there would be access. But, I don't know. That's with the industrialized farming that's going on now. We don't have smaller farmers that are prepared to do this sort of thing. You've got a big business that looks at, they have their risk management factors and everything else, but it still comes down to funding and whether they actually carry it out. And I'm sorry, but my eyes are not seeing what I used to see.
Well, we had a for years, people saying that there was a dangerous situation around one of our two big tourist cities in or towns in the Rocky Mountains. There's Banff. You've probably heard of Banff. There's also Jasper. Well, there was all this dead wood in the forest around Jasper, and it caught on fire and it burned the city down. So that was wonderful. And it was all because of neglect. But I don't know that anybody got reprimanded or fired or punished in any way for that neglect, which had a disastrous effect. You know, it wiped out, for one thing, a great tourist attraction and a source of revenue for the people there. But just such low standards of performance in functions in the government now. And you find that out after the disaster has struck, you know.
Yeah, yeah. It seems to be something we've got to, that seems to be the recurring theme, isn't it? The responsibility and holding politicians to account, holding them to actually do what they're supposed to be doing. And that's not what we're seeing. I don't think we're seeing that anywhere in the Western civilization at this point in time. So managed decline is how I think we can really only put it, because despite their Royal Commissions and their other bits and pieces afterwards, that's what we seem to be seeing. So anyway, I'm unless you've got something else, Robert, I'm about out of stuff for today. So any last comments you want to make?
Well, I had a topic, but it's a fairly big topic, so I'll reserve it for another discussion, I think. So maybe next week I can introduce it. I think we've talked about some important matters tonight, and I commiserate with you for the passage of that speech control legislation, but we're all in the same boat as far as that's concerned. They're really coming after freedom of speech, because freedom of speech is the way to stop intrusive and oppressive government policies. And that's what they have lined up for us, it seems. So they don't want the population in a position where they can sort of mobilize opinion against what they're doing.
Yes, yes, it certainly seems that way. With all the anti-migration marches we've been having, or excess migration marches that we've been having on a fairly regular basis in this country, they don't like it, and they were growing at one point. So I guess to outlaw it would be very easy to do. If the migrants now feel threatened, that's all potentially hate speech. So, it becomes a topic.
Yes.
All right. Well, that's us for today. So thank you very much, folks, for watching. If you've got a chance to have a look at the hate speech legislation on the right there, don't get your hopes up too high that it'll mean a lot, because it's written in the usual fashion. But you can be assured that, if we're not here next week, you know, it works. Hopefully not.
They can always bury dangerous nuggets in a 500-page law, can't they?
Well, that's it. Yeah. It's very hard to go through in a short period of time.
Yeah. Later on, you discover the dangerous aspects of it, the really dangerous ones. Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Robert, for your discussion today. And we look forward to seeing you again next week. This is Neville Archibald from Crossroads signing off. Thank you.
This country's not going to be saved from the top, because that's where all the rot is. It's too deep. It's going to be saved from the grassroots.